Hi, I'm Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio. Jim Bradley has the day off. WGBH arts editor is filling in for Jim. And we are back to welcome into Studio 3 for his monthly appearance, Mayor Marty Walsh, who is good enough to take our questions and yours for the next hour. You can call him at 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970, or send an email to bpr@wgbh.org. We've already got some from people that are worried about what else? The snow. Thank you. Thank you.
Snow and Olympics. That's all we talk about.
Snow and Olympics. So we'll talk a little snow
we
and
set
Olympics.
Records.
And a little superintendent of schools, because that's a big story in Boston, too. But Mayor Walsh, before we get started here, and by the way, thank you very much for coming in.
Well, you're welcome.
Did
Thanks.
It take you a long time this to get here? Good. How was the drive?
No, great today.
Great today?
You know, I was saying on the way in, it's the first time in a week we haven't had a blizzard. We had snow,
right.
But not a blizzard, so I'm excited.
That's right. Do you have any ice dams in your house?
They're all off now.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
oh, good.
A lot of them. Some of them fell, and then my cousin removed some of them. We didn't have any around walkways, but because I have a little bit of, I have about 5 feet of green space there. But it's still, I get worried about the gutters being pulled off the house.
Yeah. Well, the governor's in big trouble. He's got apparently buckets in the bedroom of his house up there in Swampscott.
Yeah.
But anyway, 2 weeks ago, you went viral. You were all over the country talking about a particular something that people are doing here in Boston. Here's Mayor Walsh warning people about a risky winter behavior.
Something going around on Twitter where people are jumping out windows into snowbanks. First of all, it's a foolish thing to do, and you could kill yourself. So I'm asking people to stop the nonsense right now when it comes. These are adults jumping out windows. This isn't Loon Mountain. This is the city of Boston.
Now, did you pick Loon Mountain on purpose? I mean, you could have said Mount Snow.
It popped in my head, and God, that's the first time I heard it, really, since I didn't hear it after I said it. You know, what I was concerned about at the time was there was some people on Twitter that were challenging people to jump out second and third story windows. And my concern was really around public safety. I didn't want young kids starting jumping off porches and jumping off back decks, and you just don't know what's under the snow. Because at that point it had been, I think it was the fourth storm we were talking about. There was a lot of problems with icicles on houses, and some icicles have fallen off, and I didn't want somebody to jump off and impale themselves with something that's under there, a grill or a shovel or something like that, and now it becomes a public safety issue, and so I was really concerned about that. But it did go viral. Jimmy Fallon, I think, was talking about it. A friend of mine the other day was in New York and came across Jimmy Fallon, and I guess he said something to the effect like, "I love you, man, Marty." So.
Well, here's a headline from the Washington Post. I love this. Mayor of Boston urges knuckleheads not to jump out of windows and into the snow. I thought that was pretty good.
I didn't see that one. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Here, I'll give you the story. There's a picture of the guy jumping out the window. It looks like he doesn't have any clothes on. I'm not sure what's going on there. But anyway, so Mr. Mayor, we were talking about this before you came in the first hour, you know, about still after all these days, there's still tons of snow on the street. There's still tons of people with cars parked on the street, and they're covered, and you wouldn't even know the car was there except for the antenna. Yeah. So have you thought about something? I mean, there are other cities that do things differently, like one side parking or maybe demanding everybody get off the street for a certain amount of times you can plow. Have you thought about, we hope this doesn't happen again next year.
Yeah,
if it does.
We're going to have a meeting. We spoke about it yesterday with Renee Fielding, the head of emergency management, and having a meeting at some point in the near future, internal meeting, to talk about how we performed, what can be done, what can be learned as far as removing snow. Last time I was on the radio show, somebody came up with an idea of moving cars on side streets over to one side so we can clean the street down. Brilliant idea. I went back and talked about it. We can't implement it in this year's snow, obviously, but certainly we're going to look at it for next year, similar to street cleaning, if we can.
Yeah.
There was a story in the Washington Post yesterday that talked about the snow we've had in the month of February, and a scientist did the research. 1 in 26,000 year occurrence happened, and it's in the Washington Post. So, this is unique. But even with, say, let's say next year we get an 18-inch storm, which we could, there might be an opportunity for us to do a better job removing the snow. It's costly because it takes a lot of equipment and it takes a lot of manpower, but it's something that we're going to look at. We're going to look at everything we did this time and to see how do we deliver services better. And even if we don't get this type of storm, say, in the next decade, at least we're planning for it. So whoever comes in later on down the road, we'll be able to have some information on if you come across a storm like this, this is what we came up with, and maybe you might want to use it.
So adding to all of this, of course, is this whole conversation about safe space savers, yeah, which started off to be kind of funny until we had this extraordinary moment when people had nowhere to park and people started slashing tires in the South End and bashing in windows, and the Globe has editorialized against you saying you let it go on for too long. How are you going to deal with the issue of space savers, which in some neighborhoods like the South End, they, despite what you say, they say out and right they don't want them there anyway?
Yeah, well, first of all, the South End, I commend the South End for taking on the pilot program of no space savers. And I'll talk about the Globe in a second. I think it's worked pretty well from what I'm hearing. And I haven't, we'll have a meeting with the association in the South End to see exactly how it worked out. And I think that I commend them for doing it. I mean, I think it's something that, just trying to tackle this issue is important. I don't know how many cars move on a daily basis in the South End. So that's another issue. Do people keep it there and not take the cars for a month? There are cars in Boston that have been moved in a month that are under snow. And clearly
little antennas sticking out.
Yeah, people don't need them. So that's easy to keep your car there and not have a space saver. But people that have to go to work every day or use the car to get to work, that's another story. The Globe today editorialized about, do I have the power or not to talk about space savers? Clearly, there's no written law on the Massachusetts or the Boston books that says that the mayor can declare when space savers come out or when space savers go in. It's just always been, I don't know when it started, but let's assume for the last 40 years, it's been the way Boston deals with snow and Boston residents deal with snow. There is literally still no place to park on streets because there's still mounds of snow. And in some cases, we can't get to those mounds of snow in the middle of the street because there's cars under them. So there's problems there, and it would be very costly to do. So I've made it clear to everyone that on what I do have the power to do is pick up trash or things that are left on the street, as the DPW workers do. So on Monday, when the trash starts to go around the city of Boston, we're going to be picking up anything that's on the street that is not trash, that is not in barrels. So if there's a lawn chair there, if there's a toilet there, if there's a table there, if there's a cone there, that's all getting tossed into the trash, and the garbage collectors around the city are going to be picking it up. I'm getting some pushback on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, any public safety concerns? Because there was a story in the Globe you probably saw this, about the trash removal guys, who some guy came chasing after them with a machete. That's how it was described.
Yeah,
people are angry.
Somebody going out with a machete, it's more than snow. They need to, there's some problems in that with that person with the machete. But we have to move on beyond this stuff. I would just ask people, when you're parking people's spaces or people in front of people's houses, right for the next couple of days, if you remove something, put it back in. The problem we've had is that we haven't had any warm days at all. We've had one melting day, if you will, in the last month, and today's somewhat of a melting day. And next week, it looks like we'll have a 40-degree day, so these piles will go down. But it's still difficult. I'm getting a lot of pushback on taking away the space savers from senior citizens. And they have a legit right. There are a lot of seniors that will drive, and they're not young, and they don't have the opportunity to park three or four blocks from the house and walk home. And so I would, people on streets, I'd ask you, if a spot has been typically a senior spot on your street, be respectful and let try and keep it open for the senior on the street.
Before we get to the calls, Mr. Mayor, we've had a lot of emails and calls about trash removal in Boston. Brendan said he hasn't had his trash picked up in 3 weeks. On Tuesday, a truck finally attempted to pick up the mountains of trash piling up. It became stuck because the plow was wide and it was in a public alley. He said he called the DPW, did not get any call back about that. And he said that if, in the meantime, he was advised to bring in his trash that had not been picked up in order not to be fined. So he feels like he's in a catch-22 where he's trying to get the trash picked up. If he doesn't move it, he's going to be fined. He wants to know what you're doing about that.
Did Brendan say where he lived?
He did not say where he lived. Okay. But public alley sounds like it could be the Back Bay. I should not jump to that conclusion.
So the reason why I'm asking that is that for four consecutive Mondays, in Boston, we had a delay trash day. Three of them were due to the snow, and one was due to the holiday. And we're back out there now picking up trash and trying to do the best we can. We've talked to the contractors about making sure one of the complaints we received is people weren't going over snowbanks to get to trash. And we're trying to ask people to get their trash as close to the curb as they can. My trash today was I brought it out into my driveway, put it in the middle of the driveway so in the street driveway so they could get it. It's been a problem. I mean, we have small streets. We have had record numbers of snow. We have large garbage trucks you know, I've insisted that we go out there and make sure that we pick this trash up. It's because of the delay that's really causes a lot of problems in the city. We're actually one thing we're doing is we're responding is putting on. We have the Hokies that usually go on typically in April. The folks that go around and sweep the streets, following the garbage trucks. I believe last year they went on in middle of April or early May. We're actually starting them next week, Monday.
What are Hokies?
Hokies are people that we hire on a seasonal basis that go out with. A broom, a shovel, garbage barrels, and they're going up and down the streets to clean up a lot of the stuff, the litter on the street, and also doing our best to keep the city clean. And one thing I will say, and I'm going to get myself in trouble saying this.
It's okay.
There's no harm in somebody, if you see trash, pick it up and throw it in a barrel. I mean, help everyone out here. It's all of our cities, and we're going to do our best to get out there. When the snow melts, we're going to have a very dirty city for a very short period of time, and we're going to get out there and clean it. But if people, I'd ask people to help me out a little bit here. If you see trash in your street, you know, don't just walk by it. You know, if you have a barrel, I mean, if there's a can or a bottle or something like that, pick it up and throw it in the barrel. I apologize to that gentleman if we do not get back to him. There's no excuse for that.
And Mr. Mayor, you can see that the lines are full.
Yeah,
here.
Let's take a couple calls.
Pick your poison. All right. Ask whoever you want.
Let's go to Stephanie in High Park.
Hello?
Stephanie, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I just have a question for you. Hello, Ms. May. I just have a question. So my question is, I understand, you know, after the first snowstorm hit, the Patriots Parade follows that Wednesday, and a lot of the snow in the inner city, High Park, Mattapan, Roxbury, there was still a lot of snow and roads. There were streets that were poorly plowed. There was a lot of snow removal downtown Boston. So my concern is, well, my question is, why was it such a concern to remove snow from the downtown area when a lot of areas in the inner city still needed work? Why wasn't that money put towards snow removal in the inner city instead of being put to the Patriot Parade for Patriots players that don't reside in the city of Boston?
Thank you, Stephanie. We got it.
Let me add the Patriots Parade, I believe, was after the second storm. So we had already had the first one. This was the second one. There was no priority made as far as removing snow from the downtown area. The night that we removed snow on Boylston Street, 90% of the snow that was removed in the city that night was removed around the city of Boston in the neighborhoods, not on Boylston Street. We did remove some snow on Boylston Street, so we could get the Patriots Parade. Overall, I think it was a big success. A lot of it was driven by people saying that we shouldn't have a parade. I think at that point we needed a little happiness in the city of Boston. We certainly were excited. 1 million people came into Boston to watch the parade. But that night we made sure that we were out in the neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods that you mentioned, Hyde Park, Roxbury, Mattapan, were all high priority. I don't know if the streets were poorly plowed, but certainly there was so much snow on the side of the roads and on the curbs. That's where the problems came into effect. All the streets were plowed, with the exception of a handful that were either missed or private ways. 48 hours after the storm, was down to the ground. The last storm was a little longer because it was harder to get to the ground because it was kind of a lingering storm. But I understand your point. Thank you for the call. And I do know that we got a lot of happiness with having a parade. I think we needed a mood. I wish we could have a parade today because... you know, we've had a week without snow, and it's good.
Well, you have a big parade in just about a couple of weeks, the St. Patrick's Day parade.
We're working on that now. That's another issue. I mean, that's going to be potentially an issue because we're talking that parade goes through neighborhoods, and there's an awful lot of snow in the middle of the street and the sides of the streets. So that's something that we're dealing with right now. We're going to have a conversation. We're having conversations now to see how we deal with that.
Is there a possibility that it won't go on as scheduled right now?
It's hard to say. I mean, we have to sit down with the organizers of the parade just because they really make the call in some ways on it. I mean, the city grants the permit. We're trying to see if there's a way we can do some creative things to continue the parade. But I don't see how it goes through the neighborhoods.
Yeah, the commissioner was saying Boylston Street when he was in with us.
We're looking at different options. But again, we're gonna sit with the organizers of the parade. I mean, we're not going to make any decisions unless we talk to them. But going through the streets is going to be very difficult.
As long as we're on the subject of the parade, I have gotten a lot of email from the Veterans for Peace. As you know, with the ACLU, have sued the city over the parade. They're the people, the Vets for Peace, that have walked behind the parade about a mile for years when gays and lesbians weren't allowed to walk openly out there. The gays and lesbians were walking them. It's kind of like the parade behind the parade. The out Vets, who are gay, are in the parade
in
this
the parade.
Year.
Yep.
But the Veterans for Peace aren't in the parade.
Yeah, unfortunately, with the parade, there was a United States Supreme Court ruling that allows parade organizers to pick and choose who they want in the parade, they don't want in the parade. And we're still working on that issue. This year's parade, the Veterans for Peace will not be in the parade, as far as I know. Again, that's something we'll have to talk to the organizers of the parade about. And Out Vets application was accepted and voted on, and they will be in the parade. We're heading towards a fully inclusive parade, but you know, it's the St. Patrick's Day parade seems to be the very high profile parade that, you know, I think that, you know, the issue around the gay community not being able to march the parade, I mean, I certainly let my feelings be known on that. I'm very happy that Out Vets are marching this year and we're allowed to march. And I know the Out Vets are very excited about the opportunity to march in the
parade. Would you like to have the Veterans for Peace in the parade?
I mean, again, I think that's something that I'll let the organizers decide that.
Well, no opinion one way or the
other? Not on that one.
Okay. 877-301-8970 is the number. 877-301-8970. The mayor of Boston is here until 1 o'clock for all your calls. Go ahead, Mr. Mayor.
How about Danielle and Newton? No, sorry, Daniel. Hi. Daniel, sorry.
Yep, this is Daniel.
How are you?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm good. I just wanted to say I called in. I grew up here, but I just moved here recently from New York City and going to Boston Architectural College.
Great school.
And for our orientation, they let us come to City Hall and speak into your earlier segment on Design Week. And if you care about City Hall Plaza, you care about design. Well, I got to say, if you care about City Hall and if you've ever been there, you also care about design. And I think I want to give props to everyone who works in that building. Because it is a challenging design at times, especially below City Hall Plaza, where, you know, second and first floors, where I went when we toured around, we were sketching. I actually was looking for the public bathroom, and it was really hard to find. It was right by the elevators down on the first floor. I got stopped by a few of your employees, Mayor Walsh. They were doing their due diligence. They're asking me what I was doing around there. But I guess
not many people go beyond the third. They usually go from third floor up, unless you go into the elections department or over to pay a bill. You're probably in the back floating around there.
You got a question, Daniel? Do you want us to get rid of City Hall? Is that what you're getting to here?
I'm getting to City Hall, but my question for you, Mayor Walsh, is this: this nice lady told me that everyone has to leave City Hall out of that first floor entrance after 5:30. I was wondering, maybe she's just talking about
security. Security purposes. We closed the up second floor, the third floor entrance to the public. It's been that way as long as I know. And we put everyone through the first floor for security purposes. And generally, what goes on in City Hall after hours is the BRA will have meetings, and there'll be some meetings in the building. But it's not the offices all pretty much close at 5 o'clock. So we try to coordinate everything through that bottom door.
Okay. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you very much for the call. The number is 877-301-8970. Mr. Mayor, I want to ask you a little bit about the superintendent of schools, because the vote is scheduled for Tuesday. There are four candidates in the finals here. Pedro Martinez.
Pedro, yeah.
Dano Bedden. Is that how you say it?
Dana Bedden.
Dana Bedden, Tommy Chang, and Guadalupe Guerrero. So my question to you is, are you deciding this today? The reports are that you're going to be having a high-profile meeting. You're going to make up your mind today.
No, it won't be today. I think it'll probably be over the course of the weekend. We have great candidates in the mix. You know, they all have their different strengths. They all would bring something very unique to Boston. And I'm very excited about the pool we can pick from. And we finished the interviews yesterday. I had my conversation today with Pedro. And we're going to be meeting with some members of the search committee, talking to some community officials. We had set up a different type of system, never happened in Boston, to have the chairman of the Boston delegation, the president of the city council, The chair of the education committee in the state, which is Sonia Chen Diaz, and the chair of the education city in the for the city council, Tito Jackson, to meet with each of these folks. So we've gotten a lot of good feedback. And over the course of the next couple of days, we will think about who the best choice is for Boston. And then the city council votes on it next week.
Is Mr. Guerrero your favorite candidate?
No, I heard that a couple of times. Yeah. I don't have a favorite candidate. Okay. I actually, they all have different strengths. And every time I meet with somebody, I kind of think, okay, this could be the person. And then the next person comes in, I'm like, well, this could be the person. And then the next person comes in. And it literally happened to me all week long. And I met with Mr. Guerrero on Monday. I met with Tommy Chang on Tuesday. I met with Dr. Benton on Wednesday. And I met with Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then today I met with Pedro. So they've all been my top candidate all week long.
Is Guerrero still a strong candidate in your opinion? He's taken some hits over the last couple of days because he was terminated for his doctoral program at Harvard. There was some question about how that was used on his resume. Yeah. And there were questions about the fact that the scores in his schools here in Boston weren't raised while he was here.
There's also I question the article was unclear because at the end of the article it looked like he was terminated at was out of the doctoral program at Harvard because he didn't finish his dissertation in time, and there's a timeline on it. So that's the question I have to get an answer for. Is it because he ran out of time because he was working, or is it because I know myself when I went to school at BC at night, it took me forever to get my degree because of work.
Well, he had 7 years, I think from what maybe I'm wrong.
I think it has been answered, actually. Peter Kazis, our great reporter here at WGBH, has a piece online today saying that in Harvard's estimation, terminated means Harvard terminated you. And if you withdrew, then that was a voluntary thing. So according to Peter Kazis' piece, it looks like Harvard terminated him, which is troubling. Which brings me to
– And he did cite the work issues.
Yes, he did cite the work
issues. Part of the reason he wasn't able to finish.
And we looked at all that. We looked when the first thing I did when he was his name was brought into the mix here, we looked at the scores of the Dever, and we looked at where the Dever was going. And seeing during his tenure here, the scores weren't where necessarily overperforming school, but at some point, the school department decided to take the McCormick and the Dever and merge it together because the Dever was certainly a school on the rise. And I think that, you know, all that's going to take into – we're going to take all that into account as the week goes on. I mean, I wasn't aware of the Harvard situation until yesterday. So something that doesn't concern me, I'm going to be very – it goes into the conversation, but I'm going to, again, based on who I feel and the city council, not city council, but the school committee feels the best candidate, that's how we'll choose.
Mayor Walsh, you know, one thing I didn't think of till yesterday, and I should have thought of this before, is that we have an open process here in Boston. So all these four candidates, their schools, obviously they're on the front page of the paper, their schools know that they're applying for a job. We had Paul Revelin here yesterday, who was the former Secretary of Education, and he was saying that this is an unfortunate process. It's nothing to do with you. It's been like this for a long time. But that if you were a real hotshot at the top of your game, you probably would not want to know the place that you work at, that you're looking for another job elsewhere.
Well, that's true.
And that hampers.
That goes back to the transparency thing.
Yes.
So if you have a meeting, I mean, I can't go out and bring somebody in here and not be willing to tell the public because I'll be criticized for not having transparency.
Yeah.
But Paul's absolutely right, and that happens in a lot of cases. It's happening probably in my public health right now. We're trying to get somebody from Director of Public Health. People don't want to know. They don't want their employers to know. Dana Benton put his career on the line in Richmond, Virginia, to say he's coming here. And it's worked out for him in the sense of that Richmond is taking votes. The school committee is taking votes to ask him to stay. And they're rallying in Richmond, Virginia to keep him in Richmond, Virginia. But the other three folks, and other people who applied. I spoke to people who didn't want to put their name in because of the public process.
So we'd be better off, in a sense, possibly, if we were able to do this.
To come down to maybe two candidates at the very end and then let it out. You know, again, it goes back to the transparency piece. And I think that, you know, in this process, I mean, when I pick a BRA board member or if I pick a board member or something else, there's not necessarily a public process. I pick somebody, they get vetted in front of the city council, and off you go. That might be the case here. But I think in this process that we've had here for the superintendent, the schools, the feedback has been the most open, transparent process in the history of Boston. Again, having a very diverse search committee, in many ways diverse, then the interviews that were leading up to having four elected officials interview the candidates. It's never happened in Boston before. Having four somewhat community meetings, sitting down with the press, letting the press be able to vet it. Because, again, press will look at stories and they'll print about stuff. So I read that to see what they found or what they might not have found. They might have found something we didn't see. You know, Paul's on the right track. I mean, Boston is a very sought-after post, as is New York and other places. And one of the comments I actually asked them all, if you get chosen for Boston, are you willing to give me a commitment here? And if a better or a bigger or something else pops up, are you committed to stay in Boston? The answer was yes.
How long did you give them a time?
The term of their contract, whatever their contract will be, which will probably be 3 to 5 years. I think it's 5 years.
Well, Mayor Marty Walsh, you're probably not going to agree with Paul Revel about this, because one of the things he said yesterday, I'm going to play the sound in a second, and one of the things that a lot of people in the educational foundations and grad school said to Peter Kazis in his piece in the WGBH, which is online, by the way, you can get it and look at it yourself, is that they thought the field was weak, and they blamed in part this transparency thing, that they thought the creme de la creme would not come here because they'd have to risk their position elsewhere. Revel was in here talking about this problem with the transparency. He saw it as a problem. And when I asked him if he had a favorite superintendent candidate of the four that are left, and I'm not casting aspersions on these people. I mean, you know them better than I do. But this is what Paul Revel had to say about the four that are remaining in contention.
It's not as strong a pool as I'd hope to see. We have a field of people who are, many of whom have got some interesting experiences and clearly have a lot of potential and have done some significant things. But at the same time, a number of them are about a decade off, in my view, the level of experience that we'd actually want
to lead the Boston Public. A decade off?
So I guess, do we have to, if you're satisfied, you think somebody's going to be able to do dramatically great things, that's great. But if you're not, we have John McDonough, who is the interim superintendent. Yep. I mean, could we, if you're not fully satisfied, postpone this thing?
I am satisfied with what we have, and I would respectfully disagree with Paul Revel. You know, when he talks about a pool of candidates, who is the pool of candidates? I asked that question to everyone. Who's the greatest superintendent in urban America today?
Yeah.
Can you show me a district in urban America that is performing at 90% above proficiency rates? There isn't one. I think we have an opportunity here in Boston to create the next great urban superintendent of schools. Wherever you go, I mean, I'm talking Boston, New York, Chicago, L.A., Miami. You look at those cities that we have challenges, and there's challenges around economics, there's challenges around race, there's challenges around income inequality, there's challenges around ELL and special education. That person's not out there. I mean, we can talk about it all day long. I think that one thing that we want to do here in Boston is truly up the educational system. You know, Massachusetts is rated number one in the country as far as around education. But when we go up against the world, we don't compete.
Right.
So let's, if we want to talk about good education, let's make sure that we can compete on a world stage. And that's what we want to do here in Boston, is up the educational system in Boston so that the Boston Public Schools are an option for every parent in our system, whether they want to send their kid to a public school, a charter school, or a parochial school. The Boston Public School System should be on that list.
Is there pressure on you to pick a black guy or a Hispanic guy because the commissioner of police and the commissioner of fire department are both white guys?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that people certainly were concerned about it, but I think what we've done in the city around the cabinet, our cabinet now is 50% people of color. Ron Dorsey, chief of education for the city of Boston, is African-American gentleman, is a very, very talented individual. You know, I want the best candidate for this job, and these four are the ones that rose to the top to be the best candidates for this job. I've had a chance now to talk to them a couple of times, and we're going to continue to move and talk to them and make decisions soon.
So we're getting lots of email questions. First of all, Loon Mountain wrote, and they're very happy that they got the shout out from you.
I heard they were happy.
And we have another email person who's asking, there are a lot of low-income residences being built. Middle-income housing isn't being built as fast, and rents are continuing to rise. What's being done to keep from inadvertently pushing out middle-income residents? And, of course, this comes on the heels of all these conversations we've been having about luxury housing, really high luxury housing being built in Boston.
Well, we announced a plan in October building 53,000 units to new homes in my housing plan. We have workforce middle-class housing in that plan to create more housing, and we're moving forward with it. So we have had a lot of interest in the city of developers coming to us wanting to build middle-income housing in the city, and we're moving forward with our plans.
We're talking to the mayor of Boston until 1 o'clock. We'll take one more call before we go to the break. Mr. Mayor,
yeah,
pick one.
Let me go to somebody who's been on the phone for a while. Sorry. How about Michael? Seth in Boston.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Mayor, you've previously said that you're the mayor of Boston and you represent all the people of Boston.
Yep.
So in regards to the Olympics coming here, once the Boston 2024 bid is finalized, or even if we fast forward to August of 2024, what level of public support do you personally feel would indicate that the games are wanted and not being rammed down the public's throat? You know, 80%, 75%, 51%, 44%?
No, it would have to be, I think it would have to be above 70, something 70 plus. I mean, you can't, I don't think 51% is adequate enough. I think that some work still has to be done to explain to people what the Olympics are all about. I still think there's a lot of questions that are unanswered. I think there's a lot of questions around the financing and how the financing of the games are going to happen. I think there's a lot of questions around what's the assurance that there'll be no public money spent on venues. So I think we're still early in this opportunity. You know, the Olympics won't be chosen until 2017, so there's still a long way to go. So I still think there's a lot of questions people have to answer. I don't think any people are anywhere near comfortable. I think the people who are in favor of the Olympics today, for the most part, like the idea of bringing Olympics to Boston. I think there's a lot of people in the middle that just don't want that don't know what the Olympics brings and what the costs are going to be and what the benefits are going to be. And I think there's another part of people just don't want to deal with the Olympics. So I'd say 70% by 2017.
Well, I'm sure we have more Olympics talk to come because this is a
yeah,
marathon.
A lot of calls on the Olympics, yeah.
Mayor Marty Walsh is with us for Ask the Mayor. He's taking our questions and yours. The conversation continues right now on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Morning Edition on WGBH is different. I'm Bob C. Joining me now is Christopher Guerin, Executive Vice President of Marketing and Communications at the Associated Industries of Massachusetts.
There appears to be this great sense of distraction, both with employers and their workers. If you have a job and you go into the job and you're kind of worried about the water that's dripping into your house, obviously your mind is not on the work.
Join me every weekday morning for Morning Edition from 89.7 WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you and Harvard Business School Baker Library, featuring an exhibit on Georges Doriot, the father of venture capital. More information available at library.hbs.edu. That's library.hbs.edu. And Safety Insurance, partnered with Safe Roads Alliance and In Control Crash Prevention Training to help educate teens and drivers of all ages about safe driving practices. You can learn more at safetyinsurance.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Mayor Marty Walsh is with us until 1 o'clock. Jim Browdy's a day off. Jared Bowen is filling in. Mayor Walsh is here with us once a month, taking your questions and ours, 877-301-8970 or bpr at wgbh.org. Mr. Mayor, you just mentioned a lot of uncertainty about the funding of the Olympics. We've been reading all week long about whether, you know, what's funded, what isn't. It seems like they're $4 billion short, and we don't know where that money's going to come from. But tell people about this deal with this guarantee. That sounds to me like that Boston's on the hook.
We've had two community meetings now, two citywide community meetings. We're going to have the city of Boston is going to run 9 citywide community meetings. And then on top of that, the city of Boston is going to be meeting with civic associations and groups that want to meet. So we're probably going to end up, the city of Boston alone is probably going to end up with 100 plus meetings to talk about the Olympics around the city. The 2024 committee has created their own public process in the sense of they're going around the Commonwealth to talk around the state about the Olympics. They've had one already. One of them is going to be, I think it was in Roxbury the other night, but they're going to be going around the state talking about what the Olympics mean for the state. As the application gets put together, we're looking at finding out what the cost will be to host the Olympics, how much money needs to be raised to host the Olympics, what the budget will be before building the Olympics up, and what the budget will be when they start to take venues down. Okay, so I'll talk about that in a minute. Some of the venues that we're talking about are going to be built by private developers. They're going to build out the venues. Colleges and universities are going to be building out venues. So even though it's going to be add to the bottom line of what the Olympics are going to cost, the responsibility of all that is going to be shifted over to the college and university. So that's what I don't know if it's been explained properly. So for example, the Aquatic Center. Let's assume it ends up at University X. University X is going to build the aquatic center to host the swimming meets and the diving jumping into the, I think what it is now. I'm all screwed
whatever
up
you
there.
Do,
you know
do
what
something.
I mean? The water, Michael Phelps sports.
Yeah, that's right. Swimming.
And they're gonna take the cost of that.
Yeah.
So that's gonna come off the bottom line of the overall cost of the Olympics. So that, let's say, it costs $200 million. Of the $4 billion for the Olympics, that $200 million will be taken off that cost. So I think they're still working on putting this stuff together. What people are concerned about is what, and I think there was some legislation filed dealing with transparency. And what I've said, and you know, when I first heard the legislation, I said, wait a second, you know, we don't need legislation to be transparent. We need to make sure, I need to make sure as mayor of the city of Boston, that I am not mortgaging the future of the city away. So when we talk about guarantees, it's going to be very difficult for me to give a $3 billion guarantee on an Olympic game when my budget is $2.8 billion a year. So how, I don't have the revenue for it. So we have to make sure as the language comes down, we're very careful on what that language is going to say. When we did the application to get to this way, this far, there was a disclaimer in there, a $25 million fee for a city if they pulled out of an Olympic bid. I insisted that 2024 get insurance for $25 million to cover the cost of that pulling out. That insurance policy is being paid on, and that insurance policy is there now. So I still think that there's a lot of conversations that have to happen around the money piece. When it comes to transportation infrastructure, we have an opportunity here to be able to use the Olympic bid as a way, I think, of helping us fix the MBTA. I'll give you one quick story. In New York City, Brooklyn Bridge Park was a park that people in New York tried to build for 80 years. It took an Olympic bid. It failed. It took an Olympic bid for them to come up with an idea to build the park at Brooklyn Bridge. It shouldn't have taken 80 years, right, but it did. I think we have an opportunity to upgrade our infrastructure. We have an opportunity to upgrade our infrastructure right now, whether or not we get the bid, to say, listen, for us to continue as an economic engine, we have to deal with the MBTA problem. The MBTA problem is not a simple problem, but getting people from point A to point B, getting people to work. We're trying to grow the economy. How does that happen? By having a workforce and being able to get a workforce to a job. That has to happen. The Olympic conversation is going to help us with that.
But one last thing about this before we go back to the calls is it's very confusing.
It is.
On the one hand, John Fish is running 2024. Well, I guess Rich Davey is now running 2024, yep, the former transportation secretary. But, you know, one hand, Fish was saying, well, there's this $13 billion bond bill that's going to cover a lot of this stuff that's already funded. Well, it turns out it's not funded. Rich Davey saying, well, all we really need to run the Olympics is some extra red line and orange line trains, which are already funded. But I think most people would think we need a lot more than that. I mean, that's kind of...
Well, it depends. I mean, again, it goes back to one of the reasons why Boston was chosen over L.A. and San Francisco and Washington is the fact that they put on a display that we're going to have a walkable games and have it within a 3 or 4 mile walk zone of all the venues. We would be the most walkable games in the history of the Olympics. I think that the bond bill that was referred to in the newspaper, the bond bill was put forth by the legislature, which earmarked some projects to be done. Some of those projects were in Boston. Some of those projects weren't in Boston. I think that it wasn't clearly explained that some of the projects, whether they're in Boston or outside of Boston, if the money's allocated, it upgrades the transportation system in those areas, which ultimately benefits whether it's an Olympics or an economic development opportunity. So I think there still has to be some conversations around that and clarification. I think there's a lot of clarification that people are going to see and feel over the course of the next few months, because there's a lot of unanswered questions or a lot of mixed questions, because I'll say one thing and then there'll be something reported somewhere else, yep, that might be a little different than me, and then somebody else talks about it. So there's a lot of information out there that's not clear.
I just wanted to interject before we go back to the phone calls for all the Star Trek fans out there. Leonard Nimoy, who, as the New York Times is reporting, won a worshipful global following as Mr. Spock, has died. He died today on Friday in Bel Air, in his home in Bel Air section of Los Angeles. He was 83, and his wife said the cause of death was end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
And of course, he's a Boston guy. We had him in here. We were all here together.
I came in and met Mr. Sprock. I was shocked.
Remember, he had the oxygen when he was here.
But he grew up right here in the West End. It was this summer. Yeah. We were honoring him with the Lifetime Achievement Award that weekend too. And he has done this great piece too. People should check out, of him walking around Boston and really appreciating the history and remembering his childhood. It's very, very moving.
Yeah. Well, he was 83. He attributed his death to smoking, and he'd given it up 3 decades earlier, so 30 years ago, and it still took him anyway. It's kind of a sad announcement. Go back to the calls, Mr. Mayor.
How about we go to John in Dartmouth?
Oh, come on.
John?
Oh, Mayor Walsh. Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you real quick, Mayor Walsh. I knew diversity was one of the issues your administration's dealing with, and I believe it was before the – sorry about my GPS –
Do you have a question there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It was like I knew that you appointed a diversity director that wasn't previously in City Hall. And I also know Governor Baker had just elevated the Office of Access and Opportunity to the governor's office last week. And I wondered, in an ideal situation, do you see your two offices, city and state, working together more closely?
I think that will happen eventually. We appointed actually a team of people, Sean Blue, who had previously done diversity hiring for a nonprofit, and that's where he gets his background. And Frieda Bransfield, who's actually from Roxbury, who knows the landscape of Boston, and we have the two of them working on the diversity issues around the city of Boston, primarily with City Hall, but also working with private companies to build out some opportunities for folks that we can help private companies, but also working with the state. So, they will work together. But right now, we're trying to just get our office up and running. We're doing a report and assessment of what our city hall looks like, and then where we go from there.
Well, you're doing a great job. Thank you.
Thank you. How about Ron in Dorchester?
Mr. Mayor.
Hi, Ron.
Whoops. Did Ron? We lose Ron?
Hello?
Ron's back. Yeah. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Mayor? Congratulations.
Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, I know you pretty good and you know me pretty good. You probably don't remember me, but I'm Jamaican and a friend of mine got me in your local when you just came there, when your pops was the BA.
Okay, my uncle.
Yeah. So I remember when you just got there and there was an incident downtown where this guy fell. I don't know if you remember, from the 5th floor.
Oh, yeah, yep.
I was the one who came in and told him what happened.
Yeah, one of our laborers died.
Yeah, I was there. I was the one who signed when he fell. He was my foreman.
Yeah, he was my partner on World Trade Center job.
Okay.
Back in 1988.
Exactly. And then I had left and... I'm going to tell you who I am. I had left and went to become a carpenter, remember?
Yeah.
That's me right here.
Okay, nice to see you. Nice to hear you, Ron.
Yeah, but you know what? They haven't been putting me to work. I'm just saying I can't believe so many racism is in Boston, yo.
I don't know. I don't know if it's racism, Ron, but you go down the hall and talk... What local are you in?
33.
Go down and see them down at 33. Go down and see John. Tell him I sent you down there.
Okay, John.
All right?
All right, no problem.
Thanks, Ron.
Ron, good luck.
you're getting things done here today.
Ron's a carpenter, and one thing with the carpenters, the way the union works is you solicit your own work and you get to work. And so he made a comment about racism, and I think that he has to go out. If you're not working today, there's something wrong because there's plenty of work out there for the trades right now. And so Ron should go down and talk to the business agent. How about, want to take another call? Or you
Go ahead, go ahead.
Let's go to Mike. Call. Michael, you've been on the phone for a while in Arlington.
Are you talking to Michael from Arlington?
Yes, Michael.
Hi, Mayor. Hey, I just love that piece of work that you just did. Boy, if that isn't local mayor taking action now for a constituent, that was great.
That's right.
The problem is there's going to be about 300 people going down to see John in a few minutes.
Next, you could not get a higher endorsement than what you just did.
Thank you.
Marjorie, give him a clip so he can use it when he runs.
Okay. Oh, all right, I will. Here. What are you calling about, Michael?
I'm calling about John Fish. I know John, and this is a positive, okay? I've known John for years, both when I was manager of procurement for the trial courts of Massachusetts and when I was assistant secretary of ANF. Let me tell you, John Fish is not goal-oriented. For John, there is only the goal. That hit. And I remember his site managers telling me that they had to meet with him in his office at 5:30 a.m. every morning.
So what's your question for the mayor, Michael?
Well, the mayor, I'm just saying to the mayor that, you know, I feel John Fish is going to get this one way or another.
Okay.
Because he is smart and he's not persistent. He's constant.
No,
my other thing is I think the strategy of dealing with snow should be changed, and that is all the sidewalks that all kinds of people couldn't get through and still can't get through. I think there's a solution, and that is to have the city contract with snowblower people, and if your walk isn't cleared in 24 hours or, let's say, 48 hours, the city clears it and then bills them just like a tax bill.
Okay, Michael, thank you for
the call. Thanks, Michael. We'll take that into account. I'm getting criticized right now for giving tickets for people not shoveling sidewalks, so I can't imagine the bills going in. But thank you.
Well, Secretary of State Kerry can pay his bill. I think other people can pay for not clearing
right.
the sidewalks.
Right.
So we also want to ask you, you were out the other night doing the survey, taking the census for the homeless population. I can only imagine what you're seeing when you actually get out there and see the circumstances in which people are living at night in these frigid, frigid temperatures. Yeah. Tell me what you're seeing.
We went out about 350 volunteers from the city. We had some other advocates there as well and department heads and chiefs. And we walked down my area. Our area was mostly downtown Boston. And as we walked around the streets, first of all, we were out there for a couple hours. The longer out there, the colder it got. So I was thinking to myself, when I first got out, it wasn't freezing. And then, you know, out there for a half hour, I'm thinking, how do you live out here? And we came across about 20 people, 20 plus people. One couple on Devonshire Street, they were wrapped up in a blanket. I had asked the gentleman, couple questions, and he was been on the street for 4 years. He didn't want to go in. He was a younger guy, probably in his 30s. Didn't want to go into shelter that night. Asked him questions about he said he in recovery. He didn't do drugs anymore, but he still drank once in a while. So clearly some issues there, probably around substance abuse. Walked down the street a little further, and there's a gentleman in another doorway that was 37 years old. He's been on the street since he's been 17, so he's on the street for 20 years.
Oh, my God.
I believe some mental illness. We asked him as well if he wanted to come in.
Is that usually the case, by the way? I've been wondering that as you've been describing these people.
A lot of mental illness, a lot of addiction, booze and drugs. And there are a good amount of people on the street just down on their luck that lost their job. So, you know, we came across 20 in total. The thing that struck me the most was most of the people we came across are chronically homeless. And I don't know what the year of chronic homelessness, but three plus years on the street. So, you know, it opens your eyes. And we created the homeless task force about 2 months ago in the city, and we're waiting for 90 days for a report to come back. And the homeless task force was put together in response of closing down Long Island Bridge about how do we deliver services. And, not, you know, we have a shelter, and we give somebody a bed, and we give them some soup and some food and blankets and a lot of them to shower. We got to do more than that. We got to figure out how do we end homelessness in the city of Boston and in the state of Massachusetts, and that's what the task force is going to come back with some recommendations for us. We opened the new shelter. We opened 100 beds about 3 weeks ago. We're in the process now of putting the package together for the second phase, which is going to be about 400 plus beds, and then we're also going to be working on how do we deliver services better around homelessness. But it's pretty sad. Another thing that struck me was that the majority of the people that I saw that night. Aren't from Boston originally. They're from whether other cities and towns in Massachusetts or from other states. They come to Boston, and really it's probably because of the shelter system here in Boston. I know we got some criticism over the last couple of months because of our shelter being shut down, but there's an awful lot of advocates out there that help folks that are homeless with food and with clothing and blankets and stuff like that.
You know, Mr. Mayor, the people that you mentioned that you saw in the doorways, were they planning on spending the night?
They wouldn't go in. They wouldn't go in.
How are they going to not freeze to death?
Well, they're wrapped up in blankets. They had many layers of clothes on, and they were curled up. And I came across a group of younger people at Washington Station, Downtown Crossing Station. And they had told me that they had been out during the snow. They didn't go in. And they were younger. And one of the folks there was a young woman who served in the service, and she has PTSD, and she fought for this country in Iraq, and you know, she just wasn't willing to go in. So there's a lot of very sad cases that we have to deal with.
You know, in that vein, there was a person who wrote in with an email earlier in the hour asking about sober housing, too, if there's any way that we can implement that sort of structure, because there is that precarious time when somebody comes out of rehab and, you know, and it's something you've spoken about, that there is that precarious time when you come out of rehab and have to reenter life and have that support system with you.
Yeah. We when I was a member of the legislature, and even now, sober housing, when I talk about sober housing, I mean halfway houses and three-quarter houses, which are run by a program. We have sober houses in Boston that I wouldn't deem sober. They're just people who are taking advantage of people in recovery by living there, and there's no testing and no programming around them. So we have to do more. And the one I don't want to say failure, but the one problem that we have had since Long Island's closed is trying to place three programs out there, Bridge to Recovery, Victory Programs, and Volunteers of America, which are halfway house programs. And, you know, we thought we had a location secured for them, and this community organization didn't want it. So we're still working. They're nonprofits, privately run, not run by the city, but we have to continue to look for spaces.
We'll take a few more calls.
Yeah, how about we take, let's go Susan in Alston.
Hey, Mr. Mayor, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Congratulations. I teach at BC, so we have that connection.
Nice.
I am calling to ask, have you ever seen the snow removal in Montreal?
Yeah, the difference is that Montreal, on an annual basis, gets more snow than us, and their budget is 4% of their budget that they put into snow removal. I think they're about $150 million a year snow removal, and ours is 18. But Montreal gets cars off the street to get it down to the bone.
They do. I've never seen anything like it. I was there last Christmas, and it was like watching the ballet. It was so orchestrated and beautiful. And I don't know if it makes sense to think about something like this in the long term, because our winters are just going to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to, again, like I said, we're going to look at, if last year's winter, my first year as mayor of Boston, we received more compliments, and other city councilors actually told me they received compliments that they never received in 20 years the way we removed the snow. We didn't get We didn't get it like this. This year, we got the four back-to-back within a 24-day period. Montreal's budget is, like I said, $150 million. Their equipment is a little different. So we're going to do some assessments this year on the equipment we use. We're going to do some assessments on how we remove snow and prepare for change. And you do have to change with the times. You know, years ago, plows would drive around neighborhoods with a map on the seat next to them. Today, we use GPS. Today, people can track where the plows are in the neighborhood. They never could do that before. So when you think, if you compare us to the blizzard of 78, and I think that's not a fair comparison, because we got far more snow this year than we did in the blizzard of 78. If you look at the snow removal, that shut the city down for 2 weeks. This didn't shut the city down for more than 48 hours. Now, if we didn't have the situation with public transportation, people could have gotten in and out of town. Now, people will say, well, it shut us down. People were able to get to work. It hurt us bad. It hurt businesses bad. It still does, because of these 6-foot snowbanks on sidewalks. Our business community will disagree with me, and I will agree with them. They've been crippled. So we have to think of ways of getting snow, not just on the street, off the street, but how do we get it off the sidewalks, and how do we get it off from between cars?
This could be costing you a fortune.
Right now, we're high 40s million, and probably, but we're still in snow removal mode. We're still removing snow every night. We're taking 960 truckloads of snow off the street. We're putting it in dry dock over in South Boston. We're still melting. So we're still in a removal mode.
So you're going to have to take something from somewhere to pay this snow removal budget.
Yeah, we have to figure out. We're in the budget process now. So we're working with the governor's office on possibly getting some federal reimbursement. And hopefully we'll be able to get some of that. And it's going to take from somewhere. I mean, we budgeted $18 million. We're probably going to be north of $50 million by the time the spring comes. If we get 2 inches of snow, our plows are out there, because we have to salt the ground. So it's costing us some big money.
You know, we're almost out of time here, Mr. Mayor, but you mentioned before that you'd like to see a support for the Olympics in Boston. Mm-hmm. So I would assume that if there is this referendum that Evan Falchuk is talking about, that's a statewide referendum.
Statewide, yeah.
But if there's a statewide referendum and it turns out that, look at the vote for Boston, and it's not up there in the majority, you would be not inclined to push for the Olympics?
Well, it depends on what the – I don't know if it's going to be binding, non-binding referendum. And I think also Council Sachem has filed a couple of things in the city council around ballot questions. And I mean, I'm out in the neighborhoods talking and taking concerns. And I know we have a couple organizations that are against the Olympics. But honestly, on a daily basis, I don't hear the anti-Olympic thing. I still think we're at a point, or I'd ask people that are listening, we're at a point to just hear out the arguments and the conversations, make a decision. I mean, obviously, as mayor of Boston, I have to make a decision as well. So if I don't feel comfortable with the fact that these games the money can't be raised to run these games, I have to make a decision here, because ultimately it's my signature will be on the document, as well as I believe the governor's signature will be on the document, as well as 2024 in the USOC. So there's still some questions that people have, and I think they should have questions. I mean, people are getting nervous about asking all the questions. They need to. And we're Boston. Boston people ask questions. And I think just like if we are the host of the Olympics in 2024, Boston people will love the Olympics. But there's a lot of answers that have to be answered.
Okay, we are out of time. Mayor Walsh, thank you very much for coming in. I should say at this point that I think what we do is we give all the phone numbers we didn't get to.
Yeah, there's
the
a couple
email.
Calls here that I'd love to follow. Joyce and Bernie, if you could just leave your concerns, I want to make sure.
Yeah,
we
hold on, you guys. Give your numbers to our crack staff over here, and then the mayor can get in touch with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to come in, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Much appreciated.
Great to be here today.
Thank you. Great to have you. Marty Walsh joins us every month for Ask the Mayor. Coming up, last fall, Wendy Whalen left the New York City Ballet. She did not leave dance, but she did leave her comfort zone. She's been collaborating with the modern choreographer Brian Brooks. They join us next to talk about their latest work. Stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.